youthful. An abstract of smileless faces above polo shirts and summer dresses, above blazers and sweats and tees for the local sports teams. But she had the sense, real or imagined, that in this crush was someone who was there just for her. There was someone watching her. She could tell herself that this was mere paranoia, absolutely understandable after what she had seen in Dubai. It was, perhaps, an inevitable, if mean-spirited, trick of the mind. But she couldn't shake the feeling. She was a woman, and she had spent enough time alone on subway platforms or streets late at night to know when something was wrong. When someone approaching was sketchy. When it was time to move, and to move fast. And so she did. She put her phone in her purse and grabbed the handle of her suitcase and began to push her way through the throngs, plowing forward with her head up and alert, scanning for that single individual who saw her and knew her and what? Was someone actually going to attack her? She couldn't say. Maybe she was just being watched. Maybe it was all in her head. But she wasn't going to risk that. As she struggled to pull her suitcase through the revolving bars, she glanced behind her to see if anyone else was trying to fight their way upstream on the platform. She checked again as she lugged her suitcase up the stairs. But a train hadn't arrived at the station, and so she was all alone as she made her way back up to the sunlight on the street. There was a cab across Park Avenue, heading north and slowing for the red light at the corner. It hadn't a passenger, and so she raced for it, climbing into it from the street side. "The Dickinson, please," she told the driver, and looked back at the subway entrance as the light changed and the vehicle started north. There, emerging onto the sidewalk, was a solitary figure in shades and a black ball cap, the brim pulled low on his head. A man. She couldn't see his face. Already they were too far away. But he seemed to be scanning the sidewalks, and then his gaze paused on her cab. She told herself it was nothing. It was a coincidence that someone else had grown impatient and decided to walk or take a cab rather than wait for the next train. But she didn't believe that. By the time she got to the Dickinson, her own airline's shuttle had left. She had missed it by no more than 5 minutes. Fortunately, Lufthansa used the Dickinson as well. So, as she had at least 3 or 4 times in the past, she slipped the shuttle driver a 10 and thumbed a ride with the German crew that was about to leave. It was awkward. The pilots ignored her, and the flight attendants whispered a few jokes to each other at her expense. But no one really cared. Mostly they understood, because their salaries were as unimpressive as hers. A ride to the airport for a fellow flight attendant? Really, not that big a deal. Still, she stared out the window, half expecting to see a faceless man in a ball cap on the sidewalk snapping a cell phone picture of her in the van. When they had left the stop-and-start traffic of Manhattan, she read the paperback Tolstoy she had with her and tried not to be envious of the fact that she was not a part of the flock. She tried not to think paranoid thoughts, but she was sure she overheard one woman say something about Dubai to another. She feared she heard the syllable moored multiple times, and when she looked it up on her phone using Google Translate, it meant, as she suspected, murder. But she told herself that it was unlikely she had heard the word correctly. Why would they even be aware of Sokolov's death? It would mean that someone in the shuttle had flown to Dubai recently, too, or would be flying there soon. Which, alas, was possible. Very possible. Before leaving her apartment, she had checked her computer one last time to see if the photos of her from the Royal Phoenician had gone viral. She'd done this every 20 minutes that day when she was home, it seemed. They hadn't. At least, not yet. But she knew that Ani was right. And they would. She knew any moment she would get a text from Megan or Jada, because she had to believe that they were following the story too, though of course not with her own vested interest. She breathed in slowly and deeply and almost managed to convince herself that no one had been watching her on the subway platform. Almost. She took comfort in the fact that now she had a lawyer. She definitely felt better. But as the van inched its way along the Long Island Expressway, she sure as hell didn't feel good. For a moment, she paused before the window and watched the winking light at the edge of the wing, the distinct blink-blink of an Airbus. She shook her head, coming back to herself before she grew lost in the slow, rhythmic strobe. She had coach on this flight because it was Rome, and she didn't yet have quite enough seniority to always hold business or first class en route to the Eternal City. Of course, a lot of flight attendants preferred coach. These days, no one felt entitled to anything in economy, and so the passengers, especially on an overnight flight to Europe, were rather docile. The airlines had beaten out of them the idea that they had virtually any rights at all. Moreover, most people checked their suitcases on international flights, unlike on domestic ones, and so there was far less stress as people fought and jockeyed for space in the overhead compartments. Her only issue with coach? You really couldn't flirt. There were too many people, and the aisles were too thin, and there were just too many families. Of course, she wasn't in the mood to flirt. Not tonight. She wanted a drink. She needed a drink. And so when most of the cabin was sleeping or reading or watching movies on their laptops or tablets, and she had a moment alone in the rear galley, she did something she almost never did. She took a plastic Cutty Sark single and downed it in one shot. Then she filled her mouth with Altoids, crunching them into bits, and using her tongue to run the sand over her teeth. When they landed in Rome, it was still the middle of the night in America, and she had neither emails nor texts that were alarming. Mostly, she had emails from clothing and lingerie companies. The world had stood still. In the van, traveling from Fiumicino Airport into Rome, some of the crew made plans to meet in the lobby and stroll to the Spanish Steps. Apparently, the Spanish Steps weren't far from their hotel, and the steps, in turn, weren't far from some pretty Tony shopping. The extra, a young flight attendant who had been called up from reserve to work the route, had never been to Rome and was so excited to be there that he was orchestrating a group visit to the Vatican. He was at once so enthusiastic and so charismatic that even one of the pilots said he might go.
"God, it's been years since I've been to the Vatican," that captain said.
He was an older guy who commuted to work from West Palm Beach. His hair was the silver she liked in a pilot, and his skin was dark and leathery from years in the Florida sun.
"Sign me up."
"I say we do the museum, too,"
said the young guy masterminding the trip. His name was Jackson, and he had been working coach with her. He was from a small town in Oklahoma near the Texas Panhandle.
"Nothing but grain elevators. Crazy preachers and people looking for Route 66,
he'd said, and couldn't have been more than 24 or 25. He was a baby. From their conversations in the galley, and while playing words with friends on their phones in their jump seats, she had come to believe that his childhood had been 1,000 times better than hers, but in some ways just as provincial. Becoming a flight attendant was at once rebellion and escape.
"You know there's a secret room at the museum with nothing but statue penises," the captain added. "My daughter studied abroad in Rome for a semester and said this is no urban legend."
"Yep. I think it was a pope who had their junk broken off and covered with fig leaves," said another flight attendant,
a part of the team who had been working the business class cabin. Her name was Erica, and she was a grandmother, but that was all Cassie knew about her.
"But they actually kept them? Had not heard that. Wow, who knew?"
"Okay. I have a mission in life. It's probably above my pay grade to get the marble men back their privates, but someday I will see that secret room," Jackson told them.
"Imagine, the Vatican has secrets," Cassie said. She hadn't spoken in a while and found the good cheer in the van infectious. But her pleasure was short-lived.
Yeah, imagine, said Erica. God, the whole world has secrets. We all have secrets. Why should the Vatican be any different?
A friend of mine was working a flight from Paris to Dubai last week. When they landed at JFK at the end of the sequence, the crew was met by the FBI.
Why?
A guy on the plane to Dubai was murdered in his freaking hotel room.
I'm not following, said Jackson. A passenger was killed in Dubai? Why did the FBI want to talk to the flight crew?
Well, they're saying it was just a robbery that went bad, but my friend doesn't believe that. Not for a second. The FBI asked the flight attendants if they'd seen anything unusual on his laptop or noticed any papers on his tray table, or he'd said something that might be helpful. She thinks the fellow was a spy, or one of the other flight attendants was a spy.
You know, CIA, KGB, something like that. My point?
There are people out there with pretty serious secrets.
An airline is still a great cover for a spy, said the pilot. Always has been, always will be. You have a reason to travel. It's easy, easier anyway, to smuggle whatever you've stolen from the Pentagon or the Kremlin from one side of the planet to the other.
Cassie watched from her seat in the van as several members of the crew started searching their phones for news of a dead man in Dubai. She reached into her purse for her sunglasses. She stared out the window, wishing she had an excuse here in Italy to hide herself in a scarf. Cassie decided not to join any of the crew on their different excursions. She murmured that she just didn't feel up to much that afternoon, but she told the group that was shopping closer to the hotel to let her know where they were having dinner. She might catch up with them then. At the hotel, she didn't set the alarm on her phone, and she didn't ask the front desk for a wake-up call, and she was sound asleep by 11 in the morning. She opened her eyes on her own a little before 2 in the afternoon, waking to an almost cat-like contentment. She never slept better than those deep, late-morning naps when she landed in Europe. For a long moment, she gazed at the large abstract of the Colosseum on the wall beside the bed, and then she watched the thin, laser-like strip of light from the drapes. Eventually, her mind wandered back to the last time she had awoken in a hotel room bed, and she grew a little queasy. She knew she should reach for her phone on the nightstand. Still, however, she allowed herself a moment more to linger. She thought of the cats at the shelter, and she thought of her nephew and niece. She wanted to fixate on things that she loved, and the moments in which she was not a mess. Finally, she stretched out her arm and grasped her phone. She pulled the sheet back over her head and looked at the screen. Was it worse than she expected? Perhaps. Perhaps not. She saw that she had slept through a phone call from Frank Hammond of the FBI, and texts. 3 of them, from Megan. The texts alone told her all that she really needed to know.
Don't know where you are, but I saw 2 photos online. Have you seen them? Call me when you can. I'm still in U.S., not flying out till tonight. I have your back. Guessing you're in Europe. Call me. Jada and Shane have seen the photos, too.
She put her phone down on the pillow beside her and closed her eyes. It was interesting that Megan had been careful to text nothing incriminating, or at least not irrevocably damning. The short sentence, "I have your back," was the only thing she had written that might even be problematic. But Cassie had watched enough legal dramas on TV to know, or at least to be able to reassure herself, that a remark like that could be construed 1,000 ways. But its implication was clear to Cassie. Megan believed that she was the woman in the security camera photos and likely had spent the night with Sokolov, and now Megan was willing to cover for her friend. She was willing to keep to herself the fact that Cassie had only returned to her hotel room in Dubai moments before the crew was supposed to be downstairs to leave for the airport. Perhaps she was willing to do even more than that. Perhaps she was willing to be part of an alibi. Either way, Cassie knew that she had to call Megan back. She wasn't sure about Hammond. She should probably call Ani instead. Wasn't that what lawyers were for? Either way, however, first she needed a drink. She should probably eat something, too. She climbed from the bed, surprised by how cold the room was, and saw the small refrigerator in the hotel room was empty. There wasn't a minibar, which meant that she'd have to go downstairs. And while she guessed it was possible she'd run into someone from the flight, she thought it unlikely. By the time she had showered and gotten dressed and taken the elevator to the lobby, they'd be long gone, if they hadn't left already. When she was dressed, her hair dry and her makeup on, she sat on the edge of the bed and surveyed the hotel room. She had never stolen anything from a hotel for herself, but over the years she had taken things for her sister and her nephew and niece. Sometimes she tried to rationalize the thefts. The hotel was overpriced, the stuff was junk anyway, and, of course, everyone else took the soap. She could recall bringing her sister a beautiful black bathrobe from France, which she had actually stolen from the dirty hamper of a maid service card in the hallway. Exotic throw pillows from Vietnam, fancy wooden coat hangers from San Francisco, a Wedgwood blue coffee service from Italy, which was on the corridor floor outside another guest's hotel room, very fluffy towels from Miami, and a brass magazine stand from Germany. For the kids, she was most likely to pilfer little decorative sculptures or small but interesting prints or paintings or photos that weren't bolted to the wall. When she took a photograph or a print, she would always steal it the moment she checked in, calling down right away to the front desk to report the blank spot above the bed or beside the armoire. She brought them images of lighthouses and skyscrapers, and the iconic architectural landmarks of Paris and Sydney and Rome. In her hotel rooms, she'd found them trinkets and paperweights of dragons, Hanoi, Vikings, Stockholm, and ballerinas, Moscow. Did her sister suspect the gifts were stolen? Perhaps. But Cassie always insisted that she had paid for them, in some cases swearing that the objects were sold at the hotel gift shop. She always cleaned them, boxed them, and wrapped them when she was back in New York. She wasn't searching for gifts for anyone in particular right now, but she noticed a small replica of a famous statue of the mythical twins Romulus and Remus as infants, nursing from the wolf that saved them. It was on a side table, atop the leather-bound guest directory and a magazine for tourists about Rome, and she realized that once upon a time it had been half of a pair of bookends. She stood up and lifted it. The bookend was maybe 6 inches long and 6 inches wide, and made of copper. It was hollow, but filled with sand. Her nephew was about to start sixth grade, and she had a vague memory of studying the Greek and Roman myths when she was that age. She associated Diana, the Roman goddess of the hunt, with her beautiful young teacher for sixth grade, Diana Deserides. She thought Tim would get a charge out of the sculpture once he had been properly introduced to the great myths. It would be a Christmas present. She would tell Rosemary that she had discovered it in an antique store, and because it was only half the set, she had gotten it for a song. The key would be to find something equally as idiosyncratic for her niece. The idea of slipping the copper bookend into her suitcase gave her a small rush. The truth was that she didn't loot like this to punish the hotel or because it was the only way she could afford to bring her family gifts. She didn't even really try and convince herself that it wasn't all that different from stealing the soap, because she knew it was. Like almost everything else she did, it was crossing a line that most people wouldn't. She did it because it thrilled her. It was just that simple. She did it because it was, like so much else that made her happy, dangerous and self-destructive, and just a little bit sick. The hotel bar was quiet in the middle of a weekday afternoon, but it was cozy and dark and warm without being hot. Most people preferred to drink outside in the sunlit piazza, and so Cassie had the place to herself. She brought her paper back with her, though she was never one of those single women who minded eating or drinking, certainly not drinking, alone. She didn't bring the book as a prop or a buffer against intrusion. She thought she might actually see if the death of Ivan Ilyich would offer any spiritual insight into the death of Alex Sokolov. She doubted it, but she'd read a little more of Happy Ever After upstairs in her hotel room and found that the story had been a welcome diversion from the maelstrom of her real life. She was starting to like Masha. She was starting to like her a lot. The bartender was a slim young guy with reddish-brown hair he slicked back and a trim mustache. His eyes were moonstone, and the uniform here was a white shirt and blue vest that happened to match those eyes perfectly. He smiled at her, and she ordered a Negroni, and then took it with her to a leather booth in the back, choosing the one beside a replica of a classic sculpture of Mercury and beneath a Tiffany lamp with a stained glass shade. She made sure there was cell service before she got comfortable. Then she took a long swallow, savoring the burn of the gin, and sucked for a long moment on the orange peel. When the glass was half empty, she sat back and called Megan. Her friend picked up quickly. "My overseas plan is fine for texting, but not great for talking," she told Megan. "So we should get right to it."
"See, if you had small children, you'd have a great plan for talking. But if you had teenagers like me, you wouldn't. The last thing you want is to deal with your daughter's dramas overseas. I'm in the same boat as you."
"Your kids are terrific."
"They're hormonal beasts who love me madly one day and want me locked in the attic the next."
"I read your texts. Are you alone? Can you talk?"
"Yeah, now it's fine. The beasts are out,"
Megan said. Then,
"Look, I saw the photos. We've all seen the photos. It is you, isn't it?"
And instantly, Cassie understood her mistake. She shouldn't have called Megan back. She should only have phoned Ani. Yes, she and Megan had known each other for years, but in the end, Cassie was now going to have to ask Megan to perjure herself. She wasn't quite at that place yet, however. She was still too sober. But the crux of the problem was really very simple. She had told Megan one thing in Dubai and Derek Mays another at the diner in New York. So far, she had told the FBI nothing. If she was to accomplish anything right now, she should see if there was a way to reconcile her two stories and get Megan and Derek on the same page. She swallowed the last of her Negroni, and the bartender, as if he were telepathic, emerged from behind that great, wonderful balustrade of a bar and was at her side, asking if she wanted another drink. She nodded enthusiastically. "What photos?" she asked Megan, stalling for time by playing dumb.
"You haven't seen them? You really haven't seen them?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
Cassie could hear the woman's great sigh of exasperation through the phone.
"There are two photos on the web of a woman who looks like you and is wearing a scarf that might be the one you bought when we landed in Dubai. You know, at the airport. The photos are from the hotel in Dubai where the guy from 2C was killed. The hedge fund guy. In one picture, she's with the dude. In the other, she's alone. Jada is sure it's you. Shane is absolutely positive."
"And you?" Cassie asked. She wished Alex Sokolov was more than the guy from 2C or the hedge fund guy. He deserved better. "What do you think?"
"Tell me, were you with him? I know you didn't kill him, but were you with him? Just tell me that. The FBI has been calling. I'm supposed to meet with them today, and I need to know what you want me to say."
"What you want me to say?" The words echoed in Cassie's mind. "I guess the FBI will be calling me, too, when I get back," she said, instead of mentioning that she already had a message from an agent herself. She watched the bartender preparing her drink and tried to will him to hurry up. She needed to ratchet up the pain medication.
"Yeah, I guess," said Megan,
her tone equal parts frustration and derision. I'm glad I'm in Italy. Where are you this month?
Berlin, the 7:30 flight tonight.
I like that flight.
You're not answering my question. Should I read something into that?
No, of course not.
Then what's going on? What's really going on?
The bartender returned with her drink, and when he placed it on the table, she had an urge to reach out and touch his long, beautiful fingers. Instead, she murmured her thanks and plucked the orange peel from the rim, tossing it unceremoniously onto the table beside her small paperback book. Then she drank it down at least an inch and a half.
"Here's what I want you to do," she began. "Go on."
"I want you to forget I ever told you that I picked up a guy at the hotel bar in Dubai. I want you to forget we ever spoke that morning in my hotel room before we left the city. As far as anyone knows, I never left my hotel room that night. I didn't even order up room service. That's all." There was a long pause, and Cassie used the opportunity to drink some more. Her stomach was empty. She knew she would be feeling better soon.
"So you want me to lie?" said Megan.
"I doubt it will ever come to that."
"It will."
"Then, yes. Please."
"Can you tell me anything more?"
"Oh, Megan, I just don't want people to get the wrong idea. I just don't want you to get sucked into this. Assume I really did hook up with a guy from our hotel. Why not just believe that, okay?"
"Because you're a spy."
"You're kidding, right?"
"I don't know."
"One more thing," Cassie said. "You haven't told Jada or Shane or anyone about our conversation in my hotel room in Dubai that morning, and what I said, right?"
"That's right."
"Okay, then. Good.
Send me your schedule for August, so I know when we're both going to be in the same time zone," Megan asked. "We have a lot to talk about. It would be great if it could even be in person."
"I agree," Cassie said. "I'll send you my schedule. Maybe we'll be at JFK the same day." Then she thanked her, deeply and sincerely, and took the last of her Negroni to the bar. She knew she should call Ani now, but she couldn't cope. She just couldn't. The bartender was leaning back and looking at something on his phone. He had a gold badge with his name. Enrico.
"Another one?"
he asked when he noticed her. He had only a trace of an Italian accent. "Yes, please. You make a good one." She couldn't recall the last time she'd had sex sober, and wondered a little now at the synaptic connection between her body image, really, and booze, between intimacy and intoxicants. She ran her fingers through her hair. She needed another drink to make these sorts of mental gymnastics go away. Some lives, including hers, were best left unexamined. She was buzzed just enough to crave a little shame, to crave this young waiter. "Campari is an acquired taste," he said. "Oh, I acquired it a long time ago."
"It couldn't have been all that long."
She shrugged. "You'd be surprised." Then, "Your English is very good."
"I have a grandmother who's American, and we have lots of American guests here."
"Tell me something, Enrico," she said.
"Okay."
"Did they pick the vests here because of your eyes?" He smiled at her, one side of his mouth curling up a little higher than the other. If he hadn't been so young, she guessed it would have looked rakish. She hoped he only worked until dinner, so she could bring him back to her room and still get a good night's sleep.
Federal Bureau of Investigation. FD-302, Megan Briscoe, flight attendant. Date, August 1st, 2018. Megan Briscoe was interviewed by properly identified special agents Nancy Saunders and Emery Leary at the FBI office in Washington, D.C. Saunders conducted the interview. Leary took these notes. Briscoe said in her first interview, See FD-302, July 28, 2018, taken at JFK Airport, that she did not see Cassandra Bowden in Dubai other than when traveling via the airline van between the airport and the airline's hotel. She said that she assumed Bowden spent the night there alone in her hotel room. When shown the two security camera images of the woman in the sunglasses and scarf at the Royal Phoenician Hotel, she said, yes, that could be Bowden. She corroborated what flight attendant Jada Morris had said. The scarf the woman is wearing in the photo looks like the one that Bowden had purchased when they first landed in Dubai on Thursday, July 26th. She then remembered seeing Bowden at the airline's hotel on the morning of Friday, July 27th. She saw her returning to her room, and they spoke there briefly. In her recollection, Bowden said something that suggested to Briscoe that the woman had spent the night with a man in a different hotel in Dubai. Briscoe said this wasn't the first time that Bowden had disappeared when she traveled for work. According to Briscoe, she does this often when she is overseas. And while these may be sexual liaisons, Briscoe acknowledged that there may be more to them since Briscoe has never once met any of the men that Bowden allegedly is seeing. She added that the woman was distracted and upset in the van to the airport in Dubai that Friday morning and was crying soon after takeoff. She also said that Bowden lost her handbag in the United Arab Emirates, but not her passport or wallet.
Chapter 11. Elena didn't seriously believe that she had killed her father, but every once in a while, especially in the small hours of the night, she wondered if she had been the last straw. Years earlier, just as she was finishing her second year of college, her father suffered what everyone assumed was a stroke. He'd lived, but he was a frail shell of what he'd once been. He walked slowly and with a limp. The left side of his face sagged like badly bunched drapes, and his words, when he could find them, were barely comprehensible. Now she had flown to Sochi for a visit. The Olympic construction had begun, but his summer estate was on a small lake far from the madness, and had just helped him from the passenger seat of the BMW he could no longer drive. And either he had lost his balance, or he had tripped where the asphalt met the first slate step, and suddenly he was falling onto the driveway. She managed to cradle his head just before it would have cracked onto the pavement, and for a moment was relieved at how quickly she had reacted. But certainly his fragile brain inside his fragile skull had been violently shaken. She knew it then, and she knew it as the evening progressed. He'd seemed fine at dinner, or at least as fine as he ever was at that stage in his life, which meant that he spoke in drooling whispers and ate very little. But it would be later that night that he would be found unresponsive on the floor of the living room. It was his live-in nurse, a Georgian who coincidentally shared the name of a Russian football team her father followed, who had heard the fall, discovered him, and called upstairs to wake her. The nurse was a gentle giant with a chin-strap beard named Spartak. Elena had been nodding off in the very same bedroom she had lived in as a teenager those weeks or weekends when she would be sent to see him after her parents' divorce. Get to see him, really, because she missed him terribly after her parents separated. He'd die at the hospital a few hours later. Cause of death? A cerebral hemorrhage. A burst blood vessel. Another one. This time, his brain had drowned in its own blood. It might have occurred moments before he fell in the living room. Most likely it did, but maybe not. Perhaps it had been a slow bleed that had commenced when he had nearly hit his head outside on his driveway. He had always been such an old father. He was 56 when Elena was born, her mother 35. She was an only child. Her parents had divorced when she was 8, and it had been nasty. Their marriage couldn't survive the crazy amounts of money he made when, as a former KGB officer with boxes of surveillance files at his disposal, he was allowed to buy thousands of shares of the Yukos oil conglomerate at a fraction of their real value. He'd then invested in real estate in St. Petersburg, New York, Doha, and Dubai. There was the fund, some of which was fueled by all that bricks and mortar, and some of it, and she didn't believe this, pilfered from the Russian treasury in a complex tax scam. She didn't believe that, because she knew how close her father was to the president of the Russian Federation. The president had been the protege of her father when they'd both been KGB. But then there were those who hinted that the president, too, had been involved. Even years later, when she left her Swiss boarding school for college in America, her parents still spoke mostly through their few mutual friends. Neither remarried. And so she was the one who had to figure out what to do with him when he had that stroke when she was 20, and it was clear he could no longer live alone in the apartment in Moscow or the dacha in Sochi. She'd come home from school and stayed nearly 6 months. She brought in Spartak, and Spartak was wonderful. He was perhaps a decade older than she was, and he had sobbed and sobbed at her father's small memorial for his Black Sea acquaintances in the woods behind the house. The funeral had been in Moscow, and it had been considerably larger. The Russian president himself hadn't attended, but he had sent staff. Spartak had cried in ways that she hadn't. She had cried only when she was alone, because in public she felt the need to represent the strength of the Orloffs. But alone she had wept. She had loved him the way a girl can love both her father and her grandfather. She had loved him because he had spoiled her as his only child, and because he had respected her intellect and her resourcefulness. He saw so much of himself in her, and always, no matter what, had been proud of her. Elena knew instantly why she was thinking of her father this evening, alone in her bed in Dubai. Part of it was the no-win situation that had greeted her when she had gone to Sokolov's hotel room that first time. Yes, she could have killed him and that flight attendant together when she'd had the chance, just taken the 22 and been done with it. The problem was that while Sokolov had to die, the flight attendant didn't. The stakes were high, and she probably could have rationalized the double hit. But there certainly would have been fallout from killing Bowden, too. In hindsight, the double bind was unsolvable. Still, if Bowden hadn't returned, she wouldn't now be facing this fiasco. That was a fact. She honestly wasn't sure how long she could forestall the inevitable. Moreover, Elena knew there would be consequences for her as well. Mistakes were seldom forgiven in her line of work. And in the end, the flight attendant might still be dead. Be realistic. One of you has to die. I think it's your choice. Had her father been as cold-blooded as Victor? Without a doubt. She just never saw that side of the man. She saw the doting father who would deny her nothing. That afternoon, she'd been scrolling through news stories on her phone and come across the assassination of a prominent Russian opposition leader on a sidewalk in Kiev. She had known it was coming. The victim had been a member of the Russian parliament before defecting. His killer was a little younger than she was, 27 years old. He'd shot the politician and his bodyguard on the street and disappeared. But he'd been recognized by a nearby politician, and a spokesperson for the Ukraine's interior ministry alleged that he was a Russian agent. The Russian president said that was absurd. It wasn't. She knew the executioner. She turned over her pillow to the cool side and rolled over. She wanted desperately the escape of sleep. But whenever her mind roamed from the flight attendant, it landed once more on her father. She missed him. She missed him as much as she missed anyone. And she always seemed to think of him when she was given an assignment like this. He was the first person she may have killed. No, she had only finished him off. Maybe she hadn't even done that. She knew the real truth of that first stroke. It was why she did what she did. It was why she was who she was. Nevertheless, memories of her father and the things she had done because she was his daughter kept her tossing and turning into the small hours of the morning.
Chapter 12. Cassie awoke just before 4 in the morning, recalled where she was, and reached out to the side of the bed where Enrico had been. She knew she would feel only empty sheets there. He'd been gone for 7 hours now. It had been a little before 9 at night when she'd been resting beside him, her head on his chest, and she'd heard herself murmuring that she was exhausted and should get some sleep. He was so young that at first he hadn't understood this was her way of gently excusing him. He'd pulled her closer to him. She'd had to explain that she preferred sleeping alone, which wasn't always the case, but was last night. She'd reassured him that she'd see him again in a week or so, when she was back in Rome. But in her heart, she doubted she would. The airline would most likely be using the same hotel, but she'd steer clear of the bar. Now that she was sober, she wondered what in the name of God she'd been thinking, picking up the bartender at the hotel where she was staying. But she knew the answer. She wasn't thinking. She was on her third Negroni. By the time he had finished his shift, and they went upstairs to her room, she'd finished five. Negronis in Rome. Akvavit in Stockholm. Arak in Dubai. Her life was a drinking tour of the world. If only she had brought Sokolov back to her hotel room in the Emirates and then kicked him out. If only she had followed through on her intentions to leave his. Instead, she had blacked out. That was how much she had drunk that night last week. And it was last week. God, somewhere the hyenas were circling. She understood enough about her body clock to know that she probably wasn't going to fall back to sleep now, but she wasn't due downstairs in the lobby for hours. And so she climbed out of bed, switched on the light, and pulled the terry cloth robe from the closet. She didn't mind the sight of her naked body in the mirrors, and this hotel room indeed had a lot of them. But the room was chilly. The digital thermostat was set for Celsius, so she upped it a few digits and hoped she wasn't going to cook herself. She saw she had phone messages. Her lawyer again. The FBI again. Her sister. She listened only to the one from Rosemary, just to make sure that nothing horrid had happened to her nephew or niece. Nothing had. Rosemary was calling to say hello and remind her that she and her family were coming to New York that weekend. She wanted to know if Cassie could join them at the Bronx Zoo on Saturday and then go to dinner in Chinatown. She couldn't bring herself to listen to the messages from Ani or Frank Hammond. But she didn't delete them either. Perhaps she could splurge and have some oatmeal and an Irish coffee sent up to her room. The kitchen was open 24 hours. Even if they didn't have someone in the kitchen who could properly top the drink at this hour, the thick cream was actually her favorite part. They could toss a shot of Jameson's into the coffee. Then, properly fortified, she could hear what Ani and Frank had to say and take stock of her situation. She googled trauma on her tablet as she spooned the oatmeal in small bites and sipped her spiked coffee. She wondered if people who woke beside corpses were scarred for life, though she presumed there was, at best, a very small body of evidence from which to make deductions. For a few minutes, she took comfort in the essays and research papers she found that suggested the families of murder victims often needed serious counseling and medication to get over the loss, equating herself with those poor souls. But then she recalled Alex Sokolov's parents and began to imagine what they were experiencing. Finally, she braced herself and listened to the messages from Ani and Frank Hammond. Her lawyer said that she had information on extradition laws she wanted to share. Cassie couldn't decide from the woman's voice whether it was good news or bad. The FBI agent said he was just crossing a few T's and had a couple quick questions, and he was wondering if she'd mind coming downtown to the agency's offices. He sounded casual, but she had a sense, that gift of fear, that he was playing dumb, that he was playing her. Surely, he suspected, she was the woman in the security camera photos. And if this was just a minor follow-up, why the request that she visit the office in Lower Manhattan? She recalled her moment on the subway platform the day before, her fear that someone was tailing her, and then the figure she had seen at the sidewalk entrance as her cab sped away. Maybe it hadn't been an overreaction. Perhaps this was what FBI surveillance felt like. There was always someone just beyond your peripheral vision. Then again, the FBI knew what they were doing. Would she know she was being watched? Probably not. Maybe this was what paranoia felt like. Though the sun was rising here, it was still late at night in New York. She couldn't yet call back either Ani or Hammond. And given that the flight's wheels up from Fiumicino was 11:05 a.m., she wouldn't be phoning either of them until the plane landed at JFK. By the time the passengers had deplaned and she was free, it would be close to 3:30 in the afternoon on the East Coast. So be it. She sent Ani a text that she had heard the message and would connect with her as soon as she had landed in New York. She added that Frank Hammond had called her twice, but she wouldn't ring him back until they had spoken. She pulled the drapes and gazed out the window. She could see a few blocks in the distance the twin bell towers of the Trinità de Monti, the church that stood atop the Spanish Steps. It dawned on her that any day now, Alex Sokolov was probably going to be buried. By now, his body had to be back in the United States. She wondered who he was, who he really was. She recalled the way he had gently washed her hair, massaging her scalp rather expertly as she'd sat on his lap on that marble bench in that elegant bathroom, and how that night he had kept up with her drink for drink. Few men could do that. Likewise, she contemplated Miranda with her serene smile and her French twist, her gift of a bottle of Stoli. Who was she? Cassie swallowed the last of her coffee and fantasized traveling to Virginia to say something to Alex's parents. Tell them how sorry she was that their son had died and she had left him behind in the bed. Ask them what they knew of this woman named Miranda. But she understood that she couldn't, or to be precise, that she shouldn't, and that only made her feel worse. She told herself that her sadness was part of her trauma. Her guilt. Yes, guilt. She wondered if people, ordinary people, not serial killers or Tony Soprano, who got away with murder, made promises to be better people. Did they vow they would do good work in the future? Actively search out and find God? Did they atone? She wasn't convinced she had any of that in her. She wished that she did. But she wasn't sure it mattered because she hadn't gotten away with murder. She continued to believe, even if she was pathetically deluding herself, that she hadn't hurt Alex Sokolov. Perhaps no one else would believe that, but she did. Moreover, so far she hadn't gotten away with anything. The FBI still wanted to see her. The photos of her from the Royal Phoenician were now online. Soon she would be exposed, fully and irrevocably. Below her on the street, she watched a blue Vespa race by. The driver, a young girl with blonde hair and blue jeans. She saw an older woman on the sidewalk with a canvas bag filled with, among other items, a large loaf of bread. There was a delivery truck parked beside a store that sold lighting fixtures, and there were two men unloading large cardboard boxes. And in the apartment building across the street, she watched the tenants through the windows. A fellow her age tucked his necktie into his shirt before sipping his espresso from a small cup and gazing down at something on the kitchen counter. A woman in a black blazer and skirt was blow-drying her hair in what looked like a rather petite living room. Another woman vacuumed. She stripped off her robe and stood naked for a long minute in front of the window. She honestly wasn't sure why. She made eye contact with none of the people in the windows across the street, and had no idea whether they noticed her or cared. It was a hotel. They probably witnessed assignations and saw exhibitionists all the time. Then she went to the shower, wiped the tears from her cheeks, and scrubbed a bartender named Enrico off her body. Later that morning, when she and Jackson, the young flight attendant from Oklahoma, were at the entrance to the aircraft and greeting the passengers as they boarded, he turned to her and said quietly,
I have a big idea.
I'm all ears.
I think we should give everyone in coach a Xanax. It should be airline policy. Can you imagine how easy our job would be if we medicated people properly before squishing them into those seats?
Cassie heard the passengers shrieking. A small chorus in rows 33 and 34, the section of coach that was four seats across, sandwiched between two aisles. And for a second she feared that someone had a box cutter or a gun. The panic had what she always speculated was the "this plane is going down" terror to it. But then, almost as one, the call buttons chimed and she saw the red dots on the ceiling there light up like a bough on a Christmas tree, and the simple reasonableness of passengers pressing their call buttons calmed her. She put down the large plastic bag with the service items, airline speak for trash, and raced seven rows forward from the rear galley and into the scrum. They were below 10,000 feet now, and everyone was supposed to be buckled in as they approached JFK. She herself had only moments before she was supposed to be strapped in as well. Jackson was running up the aisle parallel to her, and the two of them got to row 34 at almost the same time. She wasn't sure what to expect, but she was glad there were two of them, and that one of them was male.
No! Stop it! Stop it!
Was the one sentence among the screams that seemed to register most cogently in her mind. For a moment she thought, stop what? But then she saw and she knew. There, in seat D, one of the two middle seats in the middle section, was a grandmother holding her grandson. Or, to be precise, holding her grandson's little penis, grasping it with two fingers as if it were a joint. A roach clip was actually what Cassie saw in her mind. The child's blue jeans and underpants down around his ankles, as he stood between the rows and urinated into the air sickness bag she was clutching with her other hand. No, he was only trying to urinate into the air sickness bag. Mostly, he was missing. Mostly, he was spraying the back of seat 33D and into the space between the seats, showering the passengers' arms and laps. And the kid was, apparently, a camel. Cassie and Jackson both commanded the woman to stop the child, and then they yelled at the boy to stop, but this was a tsunami. The grandmother either didn't speak English or was pretending not to speak English, and she did not pull up the boy's pants until, without question, he was done. From the passengers came a cacophony of curses and groans, a choral keening of disgust. The teen girl in seat 33E was in tears as she struggled to extricate herself from a very damp orange hoodie.
Ew!
She sobbed each time she exhaled, a plaintive, almost biblical ululation. Cassie chastised the grandmother, telling her that what she had done was absolutely unacceptable. The old woman ignored her, clipped shut the folds at the top of the air sickness bag, and then handed it to her, smiling as if she were presenting Cassie with a bakery bag full of cookies. Cassie knew that newspapers put stories online well before the actual paper went to print, so she guessed she shouldn't have been surprised when she saw the photo of herself on the New York Post website on her phone on the airport or bus to Grand Central. But she was surprised. She wanted to vomit, and actually feared for a moment that she might. She was the mystery woman, the unnamed Black Widow spider who may have murdered a handsome young American money manager in Dubai. Moreover, someone had spoken with the hotel and restaurant employees, all of whom agreed that the woman they had seen with Sokolov was likely American. For the moment, everyone seemed to presume she was an American who lived in the United Arab Emirates. That's what the waitress at the restaurant had said. She'd told the Dubai police that Alex had said something that made it clear that while he was a visitor to the Emirates, the woman he was with was not. Cassie couldn't imagine what that was, but guessed it must have been some remark between them about how well she knew the city. She'd said something like that, because she had been on the route often the last year and a half. In any case, the Dubai authorities were scouring the American community there, seeing who might have hooked up with him at the hotel. She wished that Ani would call her back. She'd called the lawyer the moment she was inside the terminal and left a message. This was water torture, she decided, this slow, relentless drip. The authorities had to work backward to get to her. They had to rule out all of the women he might have already known in the city, and all of the women living there it was possible that he had met. They had to show those photos to all of his friends and all of his business associates. They were probably showing them to the people he worked with at Unisphere in America. And so it felt like it was taking forever for them to, once and for all, focus only on her. But she knew this. Whatever was coming was getting closer. When she got home, she finally connected with Ani. She rolled her suitcase into her bedroom and collapsed onto the couch to look up at the Empire State Building through windows speckled with city grime and summer grit. The sky was blue, however, and though it was August now and the days were noticeably shorter than a month ago, the sun was still high. "How was Rome?" Ani asked. "Not glamorous. I stayed at the hotel. I didn't feel like going out." She took a breath and said, "I've seen the pictures on the New York Post website." "Yep. They weren't online yet when I called you, but I've seen them too. I rather doubt it will be a front-page story in the paper edition tomorrow. It was Dubai, after all."
"That's the bright side."
"Yes, but I have good news." And instantly she knew what Ani was about to say, and she closed her eyes and realized she was crying. Again. And she didn't care. It was as if she had just gotten a call from a doctor about a biopsy and it was negative. And the doctor was explaining that she didn't have cancer. "Go on," she said. "Highly unlikely you'll be extradited. That amendment I told you about? An American citizen is indeed exempt."
"That means I could only be extradited to Dubai if I weren't American?"
"Correct."
"So then, what's next?"
"Call back the FBI, but tell them nothing." "Nothing. Say things like, 'I don't remember. Let me think about it. If they insist on seeing you, and they might, I'll go with you and we'll meet with them together.'"
"Why would they do that?"
"Want to see you? I think a lot depends on who Alex Sokolov really was or how well connected the family really is. Frankly, I'm more than a little shocked that the FBI seems to be so deeply involved. I've done my homework now, and Dubai doesn't need the FBI. They're not amateurs. They know what they're doing."
"Okay."
"I've also done a little more research into Sokolov." Cassie held her phone against her ear with her shoulder and blew her nose almost silently.
"And?"
"And everything suggests he really was a hedge fund manager. Yes, he's based in New York, but all the money runs through the Caribbean."
"What does that mean?"
"It could mean nothing. It could mean anything. Whenever the money goes through a place like Grand Cayman, you have to wonder. The U.S. can't track it as easily, if at all. The Treasury Department has something called an OFAC list. It's a whole bunch of seriously sketchy foreign nationals or groups, and American banks or funds can't accept money from any of them. So if you want to work with those characters, you have to work through the Caribbean."
"So he was doing something shady?" Cassie asked. "The FBI believes he was involved with people on that list?"
"Maybe."
"Is that why he was killed?"
"Well, we wouldn't kill him for that. If he was doing something illegal, I kind of think we'd just arrest him."
"So why did they kill him?"
"Maybe he was stealing," Ani answered, and Cassie found herself relieved that the lawyer hadn't begun her response, even in jest, was something along the lines of, assuming you didn't kill him. You know, skimming off the top, she continued. Or maybe he was running some Ponzi scheme and he went too far, got in too deep. Good God, if no one slashed Bernie Madoff's throat, why would the investors take out poor Alex?